Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by
Catholic retailers, business owners, and ministry leaders. Don't miss the Catholic Marketing Network Momentum 2019 event. Attend seminars that teach how to apply best business practices to any kind of business or ministry. Experience one-of-a-kind networking opportunities and browse the trade show exhibit hall full of Catholic resources and gifts from all over the world. Visit CatholicMarketing.com trade show page to find out how you can be a part of this event that helps Catholics build personal and professional momentum. Celebrate our God-given freedom and faith while honoring our Blessed Mother with Ghirelli's USA Rosary. Each state is represented on this rosary's 50 beads. Red, white, and blue enamel adorn its patriotic crucifix. Get yours today. Shop www.ghirelli.com.
Fellow Truth Seekers,
good morning. Boy, that music went down quick. There we go. Well, I mean, it goes from like 10 to 0 there. Little Boston underneath my introductory yakking, huh? Good evening, ladies and gentlefings. Glad you could join us tonight. Beneath the surface here at WCAP Radio 980, that was Cindy Annis behind the glass. And we are here, as usual, between 10 and 11 p.m., bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Beneath the surface, where faith and reason meets, our phone number is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. Tonight, my fellow truth seekers, tonight's topic is one that always seems to rile the emotions, and it has never ceased to be controversial. That is the death penalty, and particularly the church and the death penalty. And particularly because, for those of you who don't, who haven't been following it, the church in the person of the Pope has altered the catechism a little bit to speak about the death penalty in a slightly different way. Some people argue that it's in a more than slightly different way, but we'll see about that as we talk about that for the next hour here at Beneath the Surface. So again, 978-454-4980. If you want to get involved in our conversation, we'd love to have you. Or just jot down your thoughts at facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. Of course, that last thing is all one word. Facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. And then you'll get to the Beneath the Surface webpage. All right. There is the introduction, and here is my guest for this week. What is your real name, and what do you really do?
My name is John Tudoris, and what do I really do?
What do you really do?
I hang out at Target sometimes before I come to the show because I get here early. And a shout out to Noreen at the checkout counter because we talked about kombucha and your show.
Oh, really? Is she going to listen?
She said she's going to listen.
All right.
6 out of 10.
Noreen from Target, welcome. by the way, do you know where that what is your real name and what do you really do comes from?
I have no idea.
No, okay. So you don't watch the Game Show Network?
Not on purpose. All right.
No, it either comes from... Oh, no, I know exactly where it comes from. It comes from the old game show, To Tell the Truth. At the end, you know, they say, will the real John Tudors please stand up? And only one of them stands, because that's the right person, and the other two were lying the whole time. And so they just say, okay, number one, what is your real name and what do you really do? But anyway, I don't know why I said that, but that's what that comes to mind. But speaking of really doing things, does the state really have the right to do or administer the death penalty. We'll talk about that tonight. Again, at 978-454-4980. All right. So, John, when we talk about the topic of the death penalty, this is one of those topics where people tend to have a sort of a pre-rational sensing of the death penalty, and everybody has one. And what I mean by this is when you speak about it, some people tend to have this pre-rational sensing or feeling about it first, and then they sort of look for arguments that support that pre-rational sensing, and usually it's passionate.
So you're saying that they lead by their feelings first?
Well, yes-ish. And maybe this is a little more than emotions, though. It's more of an intuitive kind of thing.
Okay.
It's a deep thing. It's pre-rational. And I'll tell you what mine is, so I'll get it right on the table.
Sure.
All right. Ever since I was a kid, when I was a kid, I saw an electric chair, either in real life or on television. I can't remember. I said to myself, how incredibly barbaric is this, that we do this to people?
More than the guillotine?
I guess I was just thinking, just killing them in general. Here we are, civilized people, taking people that aren't, in the moment, unjust aggressors, and sitting them down and just killing them. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I thought we were a civilized country. This is so barbaric. And so when I grew up, I kind of kept that pre-rational sensing about capital punishment. And then I learned what the church taught, and I adopted that intellectually. And I would say that, capital punishment is sometimes necessary, and the church has accepted it for under certain circumstances. And therefore, I guess it's okay, being a faithful Catholic. But I still didn't feel good about it. Never felt good about it. Now, it seems like the opposite is happening today. Those who feel that sense of deep, almost necessary justice that goes with that pre-rational understanding of capital punishment tends to jump all over what Pope Francis... Well, at first what Pope John Paul II did, and then what Pope Francis did about the death penalty, saying that, you know, really holding on to the notion that it's necessary in order to administer justice. So before we get into all of the details of what has changed according to church teaching, what has been your first pre-rational sensing or feeling about the death penalty, and then your intellectual take on it?
That's an excellent question.
That's what I'm here for.
I actually hadn't pondered it until you brought that up on the show.
Seconds ago.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think I was like a lot of Catholics about my age in the 80s, 90s. If you were Catholic, you were pretty much listening to whatever you got through the news. I mean, because the internet really hadn't made its way out, so you got whatever you got through secular news, religious news, and it was always kind of colored in a certain way. It was never the full picture, and which was pretty much that people got the impression that capital punishment was wrong. And the first time that I ever...
And you got this from the media?
Okay. Actually, my father was against it, too.
Okay.
In principle, and I think I just kind of went along because I respected my father, but I remember, I was in my teens, and one of his good friends, who was also a faithful Catholic, disagreed with him on that, and he actually brought up the point that it was okay to have a disagreement on that point, which I thought was interesting.
What I find interesting about this particular topic is that exact opposite sides with opposite passions regarding it can have them rested on the exact same foundation, and that is respect for life. It's interesting how the many pro-capital punishment arguments are lie upon the foundation of if human beings are sacred, if they are made in the image of God, of course you have to kill those who kill them. Of course you do. It's such an egregious crime that capital punishment is absolutely necessary to uphold the dignity of the human person. And then, of course, people that were on my side would say the exact same thing, but the opposite in the opposite direction. That to uphold the dignity of the human person, you don't kill a second person in order to bring about the uphold the dignity of the human person. You mourn the death of the first person, but two wrongs don't make a right. So it's interesting, isn't it, how they both can be argued upon that same foundation.
And that would be, of course, assuming that capital punishment itself is a wrong.
Yes. Yes, that would be assuming that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the Catholic Church, from at least perhaps the first, third or fourth centuries, what most people don't know is that the Church was actually against capital punishment at the beginning, in the first couple of few centuries. Then when the Church became legal, with the Edict of Milan... Then the Church became more pliable to it, and Catholics, Christians were able to hold positions that, at least indirectly, assisted in capital punishment. I'd have to read it more deeply. Mm-hmm. I just know that at the beginning, we were called not to kill people, even the guilty. But throughout most of Church history,
and when we say the beginning, we mean. Post-Jesus beginning, as in the early foundations of the Church.
Correct. First couple of few centuries. Edict of Milan was in 325, so beginning in the 4th century, it's sort of, that's when it, my understanding is, it began to evolve in the other direction. Hmm. And, but it seems to me the common thread throughout all of Church history has been the natural law tenet that authority has the moral obligation to protect the innocent from unjust aggressors.
Yes.
That has been the common thread. The Church has always recognized this natural law tenet as the foundation of any discussion relating to capital punishment. And therefore, we conclude with that natural law tenet, basically what John Paul II said in his version of Catechism 2267, and that is, you know, express it in a nutshell, societies ought not to use the death penalty if they are able to apprehend criminals in a way that is able to protect the innocent. So if you can do that, you shouldn't have recourse to the death penalty, because they're already apprehended and people are safe. The other reasons for the death penalty don't seem to be all that important with John Paul II, and that is the administration of justice, deterrence, of course, even vengeance, and perhaps other things.
Actually, I would agree with you on that. Those points generally don't come out much in the writing that I've seen from him on that. Hmm. Certainly not in that particular passage of the Catechism. Not vengeance. In fact, I remember you could almost say this was in his private capacity as a Christian. I remember when Timothy McVeigh was up for the death penalty, and his wasn't really lingering in the courts or anything like that for years and years. That one happened pretty quick,
yeah.
All things told. And I remember hearing there was a public plea from him to not execute him. And that one, you could argue, was not just a deterrent by the example, but also, in a certain sense, vengeance based off of what he had done and the lives he had taken.
Right. So, you could argue it either way. If there is that emotional get-even kind of attitude involved, then, of course, it's vengeance. If it's simply, this is proper retribution in order for justice to be done, then I guess you could say that it was out of a motive of justice and perhaps not vengeance. Very often the two go together, but not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to... Something was on the tip of my brain when you were talking, and I can't remember what it was.
I don't know what you were thinking either.
You don't? You can't read my mind?
No, I've tried.
Okay. No. As long as you try, that's all that matters. 978 454 4980 here at Beneath the Surface Radio. We're talking about capital punishment tonight, or more commonly perhaps known as the death penalty. Do you know where the word capital comes from, by the way?
No.
Ah. It comes from, I believe, the Latin, the word cap.
Yeah.
You hear of decapitated or...
Really?
Yeah. Capital actually refers to the head.
Interesting.
Yeah, so off with the head.
Interesting. I wonder how that came to be coined for money usage. Like, I need to raise capital.
Oh, that's another question. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Language is kind of funny that way.
It is. It is. But I guess metaphorically, you know, if you want somebody's head, then you call for their death, right? You call
right.
For their, and you know, the old John the Baptist thing. You know, I want his head.
Yes, or the Queen of Hearts, off with their head.
Off with their head.
Yes.
There you go. Which brings us to, there have been different forms of capital punishment throughout history. Is that the music?
I think
it is. Am I hearing music?
I think it is.
Wow.
And it's slowly building.
Yeah. All right. All right. I tell you what, after the break, we'll talk about some of the various means of the death penalty throughout history. And we're going to get into the difference between the older version, or maybe you could call it the current version. Has it been officially changed yet?
I haven't gotten a new copy yet.
All right. Well, let's say the older version of the Catechism and what it says about capital punishment, and the brand newer version under Pope Francis as to what that says. We'll compare them both, and we'll talk about whether there's been an essential change or not. And, of course, that is a serious question, because it could be a very serious problem if a pope, no matter which one it is, attempts to change something that is essentially unchangeable. And so that's where the controversy lies. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. You're listening to Beneath the Surface Radio. Be back right after this. Okay, head bobbing John is ready, and so am I. 978-454-4980. Too bad they didn't have a window to the studio. The head bopping of you, John, was just right to the beat. It was very good.
Wow. Yeah. Sometimes it happens.
Yes. All right, so tonight we are talking about the death penalty, and particularly the church in the death penalty. A little controversy has been raised regarding Pope Francis's alteration to Catechism 2267 about how Catholics should look at the death penalty. So, why don't we delve right into the difference between both? Let's start with the first one. In the first death penalty iteration in the Catechism of the Catholic Church was altered by Pope John Paul II, and it read like this. Assuming that the... we'll stop after each little stanza so we can talk about it. Assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined... By the way, can you ever do that? Can you ever fully determine somebody's guilt?
I think so.
Okay.
That basically means that if it's the circumstantial evidence cannot be weak. I mean, it really have to be almost smoking gun.
So then, would it be fair to say that absolute certitude is impossible in this life, but at least a moral certitude is what we go by?
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right. I mean, only God has absolute certitude to anything, so
right. That
would be an impossible bar to reach. Okay, so assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined, the traditional teaching of the Church does not exclude recourse to the death penalty if this is the only possible way of effectively defending human lives against the unjust aggressor. Now, notice how Pope John Paul II framed that. Any thoughts on that?
No, I thought it was very good. He immediately starts with what the traditional teaching is of the Church.
However, hasn't there been a long-standing tradition beside that that the death penalty is justified simply for measures of justice, for proper retribution. In other words, the crime the penalty must fit the crime, and death fits death.
Well, in so much of as an eye for an eye, which that in itself is biblical in a sense. Of course, then there's also the new teaching of Jesus, which is basically turn the other cheek, but in right context.
What's interesting about you, I mean, a lot of people point to Old Testament passages like what you just explained, and of course the one on with the Noahic covenant in Genesis 9, chapter 6. And they point to these Old Testament passages without all that much considering how the New Testament and the New Covenant in Christ has fulfilled the Old Covenants.
Yeah, well, it also doesn't take into context the whole nature of virtue, because all virtues are actually tied to each other. So if we're talking just about the virtue of justice, that alone, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, completely makes sense.
Yes.
Because there's just restitution that needs to be made.
Yes.
However, and this is what comes about in the light of Jesus and his teachings and his example, is that justice ought to always be considered in light of mercy.
Yes. I have two comments relating to that. Number one, could you make the argument as a Christian that in some mystical way, because we're all baptized people, are all in Christ, we're all a part of Christ now, that we were with him on the cross, and in a sense, capital punishment has already been conferred to us Christ?
Well, we could actually bring that back to the original sin. The wages of sin is death.
The wages of sin is death, but could you not make the argument that Christ paid that price on the cross?
He did, but what's required is our response. That very interesting comment from St. Paul, I make up in my own sufferings what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ.
Correct. So then how do we cooperate with, and I wouldn't say add to, but add with, that crucifixion of Christ to bring about justice in the world?
What I think is kind of fascinating is that the that death, which is not actually part of the original plan for us, it actually becomes the instrument by which we can enter into eternal life.
Yes.
And of course, what leads to that death
in the most full
suffering.
Way. Yeah. Yeah. I would just to technologically tweak something you said. Other Christians would make the argument that we actually enter into eternal life beginning with baptism and with the other sacraments.
Yes, yes we do.
So I know what you mean. Fully enter eternal life.
Correct.
At death, yes. One thing that the New Testament at least gives us is the only time Jesus was directly involved in a capital punishment question. And that is the adulteress.
No, actually...
Oh, there was another one.
That was actually with Pilate.
With Pilate, okay. But let's talk about the adulterous one, because Jesus had the power at that moment.
Yes.
The Jewish elders came to him with a woman that just committed adultery. And, of course, in our time and states, adultery is not a capital crime. But put your mindset back to pre-modern times, particularly ancient Israel. Adultery certainly was a capital crime. For the Jewish people. So they brought this adulteress to Jesus, and Jesus apparently was sitting on the ground, and they said, Rabbi, this woman has been caught in adultery. What do you think we should do? And Jesus continues to write with his finger on the ground, almost like he's ignoring the question. And then they prod him again, and Jesus simply looks up and says, let he who is without sin cast the first stone at her.
And then starting with the eldest, they drop their stones.
One at a time, they drop their stones, and they go away basically defeated in a psychological sense. It's like, we wanted to, they wanted to catch Jesus, because if he said stone her to death, then he'd be he'd have problems with the Roman officials, who said that the capital punishment can only be administered by us. And if he said don't stone them, then he'd be in trouble with the Jewish officials, who in Mosaic law, that's the law of the land, you have to stone adulteresses to death. So Jesus simply said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Now, could we take this scene in the Gospel of John chapter 8 and apply it in any way to our understanding or mentality or attitude towards capital punishment today?
We could, but I think it's important to perhaps try and marry that at least a little with the conversation with Pilate.
Okay, I want you to enlighten us about that.
All right, so you mentioned how Jesus basically had the authority with the adulterous woman. When we skip forward to Jesus' own suffering and then eventual death, and there's this conversation that he has with Pilate, and of course, basically, Pilate almost seems to be sympathetic towards Jesus, and he says, don't you know I have the power to, free you?
Yes.
And he basically says, you only have that power because of the Father above.
It has been given to you by God above, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which,
and so that might be actually an indirect a foundation for an argument for capital punishment.
In so much as that the secular state is basically given that power to administer. And
yeah.
Of course, where the church comes into play is how to reconcile that with a right moral order.
Right, right. So in other words, the church, particularly today, is asking the question, not necessarily is it just in terms of strict justice. They're asking the question, is it good?
I would say even more so, what are the conditions in which it can be applied?
Okay.
And basically, if the conditions are such that one can avoid it, then one ought to.
Okay. Let's look at the second paragraph of the older version. It states this. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority will limit itself to such means, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the common good and are more in conformity to the dignity of the human person. So, John Paul II speaks of the common good and the dignity of the individual. Your thoughts.
And also he talks about basically using proportionate means in force. In a very similar, analogous way, like the just war theory, where if someone's actually using force in war, they're only supposed to do so as much as is necessary.
To stop the aggressor, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's a means of defense. And if you can stop the aggressor without killing them, then you should do that. Excessive force is never moral.
That's the idea.
Okay. Let's look at the old version, the last stanza of the older version. And that is this. Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself, The cases in which the execution of the offender is absolutely necessary are very rare, if not practically non-existent. Now, that is not necessarily a doctrinal statement. It's more of a descriptive one for pastoral reasons.
Applying prudential judgment on, and again, this goes to the point of the church talking about how to best apply it within the moral order.
So he's speaking not necessarily of an unchanging law, but rather of the situation today and the circumstances that now the question of capital punishment is in, rather than ancient or medieval times, for example.
Yes, and I would say tying in the first paragraph with the third one, one could very legitimately say that a society with current means of incarceration, which are would actually be permitted to have officially on the books capital punishment, but only with very strictly defined means.
Okay.
For doing so, and so basically, it's you know, break in case of emergency type of deal.
So it's not necessarily what many people are sort of thinking about today, that it depends on the victim. Like, for example, hate crimes.
Yep.
Or killing a police officer.
No, it would be very objective moral conditions that would relate, prompt it.
But relating to the defense of the innocent, not necessarily who the victim is. I just want to make that straight, that clear. A lot of people today are looking towards the victim and saying capital punishment should be administered if you kill X.
You kill a cop.
You kill a cop, or you kill somebody from racial hate, or something like that, or a child. You're saying, this isn't what the church is saying. You're saying, what the church is saying is, if there's no way to protect the innocent from this unjust aggressor, then it's morally permissible, but it doesn't necessarily matter who the victim is crime.
That's what I'm getting from the reading. There's no distinction on there.
Okay.
So, for example, if someone were to say, if you kill a cop, you get the death penalty.
Right.
The reason why they do that mainly is to preserve a certain structure and order in society.
Yeah, perhaps for a deterrence, so that cops could be a little more protected.
Exactly.
And in that respect, you can understand that, because they're on the front lines.
Oh, yes.
But then there are arguments, of course, does it really deter, and all of that kind of stuff. So that's for another show. But that's where the older Catechism 2267 was for several years, until it was just recently changed this week. So, should we go over the newer version and
sure.
Compare them?
All
right. Okay. All right. Well, I think Boston needs to do the guitar riff right now.
I think they do. They're riffing away.
There it is. There it is.
I'm feeling the riff.
Okay, well, let's feel the riff together for another minute during a commercial break, and then we'll come back and we'll compare both and come up with some kind of opinion as to whether this has been essentially changed or not, and go from there. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano. My guest tonight, Mr. John Tudorus, the Church and the Death Penalty. Be back in a moment. We're back. Back are we, my fellow truth seekers, trying to get a grasp on the death penalty with my guest, Mr. John Tudorus, and you. So our phone number to get involved in our conversation, 978-454-4980, and Beneath the Surface until 11 p.m., and then Cindy's Vinyl Vaults. All right. Before I get going with John, isn't it interesting how this often goes consistently on an ideological bent? Most people who are otherwise conservative in their thinking, and I suppose many people would categorize me as that, would be for the death penalty, which I happen not to be. And most people who are liberal on many other issues, or progressive, are usually against the death penalty. Do you find that interesting?
I kind of do. What's even more interesting is those on the liberal side also tend to be in favor of abortion.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Which is very odd.
Yeah. The liberal side is for the killing of the innocent, but against the killing of the guilty. Whereas the conservative side usually is against the killing of the innocent, or the preborn, and for the killing of the guilty. And basically, the church is saying, hold on, you both got it kind of wrong here. If we are to uphold the dignity of the human person, even the criminal, if we are called to do that, as God says, to love your enemy and to pray for those who persecute you, for God shines the sun on both the good and the bad, and he makes it rain on both the good and the bad, and shouldn't we have that attitude? Then the church would say, wait a minute, let's try to be against both. Certainly against abortion, because it's intrinsically evil. You can never kill the innocents, regardless of where they're dwelling or their stage of maturity. Capital punishment, of course, is not intrinsically evil, so there is wiggle room there for circumstantial situations. But, of course, the church's attitude is, even though the death penalty is possible, we should work to try to make it unnecessary. And I guess that's where we are right now.
Yes, and I would almost actually say that that was beneath the surface, if you will, in the prior version, the one that's attributed to John Paul II.
Yes.
And, I mean, I've read both, and I actually favor the older version because it seems to put things in perspective, and it also, I suppose, in its... And it's more precise. For example, in this one where it talks about being inadmissible.
Yeah, we're about to get to that, yeah.
Oh, yep. I'm totally jumping ahead.
No, it's okay. We're about to read it. But yeah, that's the tricky word, and that's the word that everyone is jumping on. And I honestly think and hope that the Vatican relatively soon will come out with an explanation or a clarification of that word, because it's not really a theological word, inadmissible. It's, you know, the theological terms usually are
legal term.
Intrinsically evil means it can never be done under any circumstance, which means it was always evil and always will be evil. And he doesn't go that far in saying that capital punishment is intrinsically evil. But he does say that at least today it's inadmissible. But some people would say, well, even to say that, you're contradicting the possibilities of some people not being able to protect themselves from unjust aggressors.
Oh, sure. What about those societies that don't have, incarceration methods, for example, just that we take for granted here in the United States?
Right, right.
If I'm in some third world country and I don't have those means, I might actually be...
And there's a dangerous criminal loose?
I might actually be required, if I'm the leader... Hmm. To actually administer the death penalty morally, I would be responsible for doing so.
Now, according to the older version of 2267, John Paul II states that that's virtually unheard of today in the modern world. Now,
that's the key.
Yeah, virtually.
Modern world.
And modern world.
A.K.A. first world.
Oh, I thought it meant actually time, not necessarily the first world or the developed world.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting one too. How do you think of that? How do you interpret modern worlds?
Yeah.
But let's go to the newer version. This is the more, at least the newer, with some people, controversial alteration that happened this week of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. All right. So 2267, and again, there are three stanzas here, three paragraphs. We'll stop after each one. Recourse to the death penalty on the part of legitimate authority following a fair trial was long considered an appropriate response to the gravity of certain crimes and an acceptable, albeit extreme, means of safeguarding the common good. That's the first stanza. Any thoughts about that?
Not as precise as the prior version.
Yeah, it sort of says... well, actually, not sort of. It exactly says that it was long considered an appropriate response. It doesn't say it was an appropriate response necessarily here, right?
Yep.
Which makes you wonder, you know, could it have been considered an error, an appropriate response?
Oh, sure. Had the death penalty been administered unjustly by those in power in the past, I have no doubt about that.
Hmm. Okay, let's go to stanza two of the newer version. Today, however, there is an increasing awareness that the dignity of the person is not lost, even after the commission of very serious crimes. I'm going to stop right there for a second. A lot of people disagree with this somewhere deep in their passions. If you were to skim the surface and give them truth serum, they'd say, this is nonsense. If people act like animals, they should be treated like animals. Your comments to that?
Well, the ideal is that... if we're talking about the nature of what we're made for, we're made in the image and likeness of God. So
okay.
Even if we debase ourselves,
yeah,
that doesn't change the fact of the whatness of what we're made for. And the ideal is that even those who have debased themselves to such a lower level, like the lower animals, that we would ought to desire for them to be redeemed.
Yeah, so we're arguing right now with regard to people who have killed other people.
Yes.
But murder isn't the only moral crime. I mean, a lot of people who, Catholics would call it mortal sin, have trespassed against the moral order in very serious ways. We all have.
Sure.
Sometimes in our lives. Should we be given, in a sense, if, you know, the death penalty? And I don't mean let's talk about a secular society killing people for severe sin, moral crimes
sure.
against humanity. But
well, that
certainly,
was more the Mosaic law.
Yeah, certainly pre-modern societies in Islam, in some Islamic circles, they still have that mentality.
Well, they adopted it from the Mosaic law.
So at least there was sensibility from the Mosaic law that serious sin is serious. It violates the natural order. It pollutes the of the human nature, and it's a crime against humanity. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily should be against civil law, but it's serious. So should we look at ourselves and say, if I want God to have mercy on me, shouldn't I want it for others?
We should.
And I think that's one
we
of...
We should.
Yeah.
I suppose maybe just a quick appeal to Aquinas in regards to how much the civil society should regulate morals. And he was actually of the opinion that it should actually be limited to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about, for example, public safety, things of that nature, then it becomes very important. But, for example, when he talked about prostitutes, if you have the state trying to ban every prostitute, I mean, you know, where how are they going to effectively do that with their resources, plus try and run the infrastructure? And it really becomes a loss. It's not a lost cause, but you're not effectively using your resources.
There are practical questions there, yeah. And I would just say a general statement that the less self-governance there is with people, i.e. the less virtue, the more the state has to take over.
And that's the ideal, really, is that there is a self-governance going on.
Yeah, and there ought to be, and the less virtuous we become, the more we are in need of government and law, civil law, to take... fill that void.
Accountable.
Yeah, fill that void. 978-454-4980. We're going over the newer version at the moment of the church's teaching on the death penalty. Let's see. Today, very serious crimes. Okay. In addition, it continues, a new understanding has emerged of the significance of penal sanctions opposed by the state. What does that mean?
So, what do you mean by new understanding? Is it is it new, or is it more of a deeper development of what was prior understood?
Which is what?
And then, of course, the penal sanctions, what are they referring to there?
I'm asking you.
Well, that's a good question. That's why I'm raising the questions.
So, we need to think about that sentence as we continue. Lastly, more effective systems of detention have been developed, which ensure the due protection of citizens, but at the same time do not definitively deprive the guilty of the possibility of redemption. So Pope Francis is recognizing that there are more effective means of detaining people than there used to be.
Yes, there are.
And hence you don't have to kill them to keep the innocent safe.
That's the assumption. And the assumption, of course, in this text is referring to people not within the society of incarceration, those in jail.
Yes.
So what about the safety of those in jail? If you have, for example, I'm a mafia hit guy, and I have no problem whacking someone, they put me in jail, and I take out a few people because my higher up tells me to do so, I'm a danger to those people in there.
Okay, so I've heard these arguments, and they're not bad arguments, certainly, that dangerous criminals, even in prison, if they're not executed, can kill fellow prisoners or guards, and they can order hits still from jail somehow, some way, so that people outside of jail can still be killed by this guy's so-called authority. So that could be a potential problem. Now, I think if putting those two things together, Francis is probably saying, if he has... My assumption is always that he's aware of these questions, or else he wouldn't have done this. So the presumption there, if you put that together, he is probably saying that we have the ways and means to even stop that. The question is, are we willing to... Can we conjure up the will and the creativity to stop criminals from doing these horrible things, even in prison? I think he's saying we can, but will we?
I think that's it. What I got from this, and even reading from the CDF, and the smoking gun statements are right at the end.
Yeah.
Of the so CDF is just the Congregation for Doctrine and Faith.
Yeah.
They have an explanatory letter that goes with this.
Yeah.
And it's very clear in there that they're actually hoping that the updated piece on the death penalty in the Catechism spurs people towards this.
Right.
Of course, the problem is that it's. I don't think it's taking it at face value the way it should be. I mean, for example, the old version is also hoping for that, too.
Yes.
But it seems to be much more clear in how it's describing it.
And both versions seem to care about the potential redemption of the criminal.
Yes.
All right. Now, again, a lot of people on the other side of this question would say, why isn't there explicit caring about the victim and their families? Do you have a quick response to that?
Well, do they mean caring, meaning to see justice the way they think justice is, which is to see the guy cry?
Right. Just in other words, just because there is no verbiage in the catechism regarding the death penalty, regarding the innocent victims, doesn't mean that the church doesn't care about the innocent victims. Obviously,
right.
They do.
The other thing I would just
add, and they care about their families, certainly,
is that when people know when they're going to die, that in itself, the immediacy of their death tends to spur people on to think more about the nature of their immortal soul and the direction they're going.
And that is another common argument for the death penalty.
Yes.
Because you know when your end is. 4 weeks from today, I'm going to die.
History is filled with examples of people turning things around because they know they're going to die.
Inner repentance and conversion.
That old saying, there's no atheists in foxholes.
That's a good point. Which brings us to the very last stanza of the newer version of the Catechism, which reads like this. Consequently, the Church teaches, in light of the Gospel, that the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability of the dignity of the person. And she, as in the Church, works with determination for the abolition, for its abolition worldwide. Strong language there.
It is.
And a skeptic would say, what does that say about the past 1,000 or 1,500 years of church thinking on this?
May I add the companion piece to that? So this is the very last bullet point, if you will, from the CDF's letter that accompanies this change.
Okay.
And it goes as follows. The new formulation of number 2267 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church desires to give energy to a movement towards a decisive commitment to favor a mentality that recognizes the dignity of every human life and in respectful dialogue with civil authorities, to encourage the creation of conditions that allow for the elimination of the death penalty where it is still in effect.
Now, that last sentence there is important, because that question about can't dangerous criminals still kill from inside of prison, the Vatican is saying, right now, this is meant to spur on civil authorities to work on this, because apparently there is confidence that this can be overcome.
That seems to be a logical contradiction when you have inadmissible in the official text of the Catechism, and yet a acknowledgement here that
you have to work towards it.
You have to work towards it, and it's not there.
And that's why I say I hope eventually the Vatican comes out and clarifies that term inadmissible.
My hope is that it gets completely revised, period.
Okay.
And perhaps, I don't think it's going to happen, but I just think looking at things logically, the prior text from John Paul II was much more clear.
It was clearer, and seems to work better.
Yes.
Because of its clarity and its consistency.
And acknowledgement of the longstanding tradition, too.
Yeah.
The ideal would be to work for something where you don't have to rely on it.
So then perhaps you're saying that your opinion is that this new teaching doesn't contradict the teaching to a serious degree, but it muddles it in a way that isn't as clear as the last version.
I agree. My two senses, it was a completely unnecessary change.
It was unnecessary. But
Now the letter that actually accompanied some of those sentiments, I think, are fantastic.
Yes.
Like that point number 10 is great, to actually work towards it so that you don't need it.
Yeah. But I guess the bottom line here when it comes to the controversy is he never used the term intrinsically evil. He never said it's a moral absolute, and therefore there is
no change in doctrine.
No change in doctrine, no break. No break from tradition. Is that fair to say?
Prudential usage, it should be inadmissible, but the backup letter confirms that we're not there yet.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Mr. John Tudors, for your insight. And thank you for listening. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. Paul Morano with my guest this week, John Tudors, pondering the death penalty. Thanks for listening, and continue to ponder, and give us a let us know your thoughts at facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. Paul Morano signing off, Beneath the Surface signing off. Next, Cindy's Vinyl Vault. Have a great week, everyone.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.